NetBox Labs helps companies build and manage complex networks. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
Packet pushers.
Hello and welcome to Network Automation Nerds Podcast, where we explore the latest in network automation from a practitioner's perspective. I'm your host, Eric Cho, a network engineer who loves everything about network automation. Today on the show, we have a very special guest, which is a continued conversation with Kirk Byers, the founder of Twin Bridges Technology and the creator of the popular NetMiko Python library and many other online courses. Kirk is at the forefront of network automation since the beginning. In fact, I've taken several Kirk's classes when I first started my network automation journey, as we have discussed in the last episode. Last episode, we talked to Kurt about kind of his origin story, how he got to creating courses, creating the open source library, and the background and economics of course creation, getting signals on which course to create. And what we ended our conversation at was the Git course that he's working on. So I'm also interested in where we left off was kind of the lessons learned from, you know, creating this course, right? So what are your thoughts about, you know, you mentioned it's a personal interest for you to dig deeper into Git. So what entailed that?
I mean, I think it's pretty easy. Well, not really easy. It sort of has its own complexity. But with Git, one thing you end up doing is you end up learning a set of commands that sort of work for your workflow.
That's right.
And then you expand on those when you run into problem situations where whatever you've done no longer works properly. Like, oh, I just committed something that I didn't want to commit. How do I undo that? Or right. I've got a pull request that has 8 million differences in it. And how do I fix that via rebasing it? So you build these sort of, this works, but I don't really understand what's going on very well. Right. Paradigms in, I think it's been interesting for me to dive into a little bit more of just like, okay, well, what's really going on here at a deeper level and give me a lot better understanding. And then to try to convey that to other people, you know, while not overwhelming them with complexity, still giving them what they need to know, but also giving them a better understanding of what's actually happening here.
Well, give me an example of that, because when you say rebasing, that's exactly the example I was going to get. Is I have 5 commands where I use on the daily basis, or, you know, bi-weekly basis or weekly basis to check in my code. But it sends like chills down my spine when I'm thinking about I need to rebase this whole thing. So give me an example of something that, you know, you think it's kind of like that outside second layer of circle?
Yeah. So if we look back at that rebasing example, so as an open source maintainer with NetMiko, you'll get these pull requests that come in. And what you'll see in the differences in the pull request is you'll actually see a bunch of changes that you've already approved in previous pull requests from other people that sort of get undone and then get redone.
And that typo you keep on correcting and making and correcting.
And across time, you know, across of being a maintainer for a while, you realize, oh, the person that submitted the pull request, they just didn't have the right starting point, i.e. Their develop branch that they based things upon, their NetMiko develop branch, was just out of date.
Mm.
And then they made a sequence of commits, but Git depends on the order things happened. So if their sequence of commits doesn't exactly match what NetMiko's sequence of commits for its develop branch is, then it can cause all sorts of things to start to appear that as the maintainer of the project, I don't want to review a pull request that's really just changing 2 files, but then is flagging 40 files. Is haven't changed. I mean, a lot of times what you do with those pull requests, like literally when you see them and you see like it's a 40 file change, it's like you just sort of tell yourself, oh, too hard, I'll look at it later, and later never comes. Right. So across time, you sort of realize, oh, this just needs to be rebased, meaning it's bringing the previous developed branch of the person that committed that. Let's just say it was you that committed it. Okay, I need to bring Eric's developed branch up to the same starting point as the main NetMiko developed branch. Mm-hmm. And then he can make his changes to his two files on top of that. And so then when he submits his pull request to me, all I see is, oh, Eric changed two files, and that's it. And it's like, you know, a 5-minute review of the process. Oh, this looks good. Okay. Yeah, we can accept this in. But there's a lot of things that are baked into this. Is like, okay, well, what is this commit history? How does Git even track commits? Why does Git even view this change in order of commits as being different? And then you could obviously dive into like, oh, what the heck has to happen for rebases to work, let alone like things like, okay, well, if we get into merge conflicts, like why did this merge conflict even happen? Why do I care that, you know, having big merge conflicts might be problematic and difficult to deal with? And why might I want to make those be smaller? So there's a lot of sort of things that are helpful to know about as far as what's going on. And then you can also segue when we start talking about continuous integration and, you know, bolting on some sort of a CI tool onto that is like, okay, well, how do we do that? What does that mean? Or, you know, what does that entail? And, you know, GitHub Actions is built on YAML. So there's a certain YAML syntax. It's definitely not clear. It's another example of like, you just sort of cobble together something that works that somebody else did.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't really understand, like at least not me, until I started diving it in more. Is like, well, it sort of works. I sort of have a vague understanding of what might be going on, but not really. So having this more knowledge on these things can be helpful for you to deal with problems, and also to like higher level, maybe have like, well, what kind of workflow should we have? How should we structure our Git? Should we be doing a lot of small changes? You know, questions like that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you're sort of just bringing in more awareness and understanding. So even if you don't work on rebasing every day, at least you have kind of this basic understanding of what it does. And it's helpful to have you, who's more knowledge, to rebase that so that it bring me into this more of an agile, I would say, mindset where the incremental changes are being factored in, as opposed to you're looking at this jumbo change that you don't want to even look at until next week, that never comes. So you mentioned Git kind of being the first stop in doing your CI/CD and testing, right? So are those two of the area that you see maybe there's gap in knowledge that you could bridge? Are there going to be courses on, you know, testing and CI/CD that we could look for GitHub Actions?
Yeah, so probably what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the CI/CD as part of this Git course, because it inherently directly ties in. It's probably going to be only GitHub Actions. Right. It's maybe possible that I build like a second bonus lesson or something for like GitLab, their CI/CD system. You know, I have to search around a bit more on what are other popular CI/CD systems. I mean, we sort of had Travis for a while, but it sort of imploded. So Jenkins. I don't know if I think it's worthwhile, but like I'm probably going to research and see what other people are really using. Obviously, there's Jenkins, but yep. I don't really want to do
Jenkins. You're getting into this plugin hell, or you know, whatever they call it, to like start maintaining everything that's not core Jenkins, and you're so afraid of upgrading to break these other surrounding stuff.
Yeah, so initially I'm just going to do GitHub Actions. Maybe I do something with GitLab, but that's definitely like, well, maybe that's 30, you know, 1 in 3 that chance it happens, 2 in 3 it doesn't. And then I'm thinking maybe in the fall, I might try to do another course that's more straight testing oriented, mm-hmm. probably wrapped around more of PyTest. I have not even thought about the content of this course really at all, besides something that's more testing focused and wrapped around PyTest. But you could obviously start to do things about, well, what if I bring Container Lab into that as part of the workflow and try to build more auto-generated, where we couple PyTest with some sort of dynamic building of lab environments that, you know, you could view as test environments in some way, and how to pull that off. But to try to bridge that gap of like, well, how can we move the testing world forward for network automation? You know, it seems like there's been a lot of work going on with learning programming. There's a lot of work going on with like information systems. So like the NetBox and the Nautobots. people have tried various things in testing, and there's certainly work going on, but it's definitely still an area that I think we need to move the needle on and move farther down this road on. So there's a good chance that, you know, after the Git course, I'll do an additional course on testing in some way.
I agree. That's the area where I see a lot of opportunity, as you have, for bridging that gap on testing. As you alluded to in the last episode, we don't need the full digital twin, right? Like the CCIE lab, for example, it only has 8 core devices plus like 3 border devices. At least when I was taking it, it just had 8 devices, but it could mimic a lot of different situations and scenarios. You just had to fit it into the right context. So same thing with testing, I would say that you don't need a digital twin, but you just need to have enough for, you know, cover 80% coverage or whatnot. So I'm looking forward to those.
And almost everyone is not going to have a digital. I mean, it's like not even just like, well, you don't need it, but you're not going to have it. Because like, well, even if you're a smaller company, well, that also means you have a smaller budget. So it's just not going to happen. So you definitely have to fall into more, well, can we cover, you know, the 80% of the test cases? You know, can we cover some broad swath of thing that's valuable
right
in some way? But we're not going to cover everything, and that's fine. But we can cover a lot of things, and we can do a lot better than we're currently doing.
Yeah, even 40% is better than zero, right? Then it's just a matter of increase that coverage on cost-benefit analysis. I mean, when I was working for the cloud provider, you know, we have the virtualized lab, and we have the bake-off, and we have the limited set. And before we do actual deployment, we'll do it in the real lab and just a subset of it, right? So it's almost like you have to have that mindset first. You have to go from 0 to 1, and that is super difficult. Then going from, you know, 1 to 1.5, 1.2 is simply a cost-benefit analysis on how confident, how much risk do you want to take?
Yeah, and I think some people throw it up more as like an obstacle to put in their way to give them a pretext for not doing automation, but they know it's impractical to like recreate tens of million, hundreds of millions of dollar equipment. They know that's never going to happen.
Right.
But you can, in fact, do a lot of testing. You can't test everything, but you can test a lot of things. So let's see how we can improve the situation.
Yeah. I mean, I look forward to that part of your course where I look up to you to strike that balance between what is good enough at this point, right? Like, you know, you should have, you know, PyTest could get your coverage to this point, and you could have a container lab. If you have, I don't know, 6 cores, this is how much, you know, devices that I was able to launch and cover like these test courses. So much easier to learn from you than to, you know, go bang my head against the wall so many times.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things that are environment specific and that
right.
I'm not going to know for company XYZ what their core problems are. I can try to give them a framework that might help them improve their test situation, but they're going to know their environment and like, what are their things that like really are very bad problems for them that, you know, they really have to avoid.
But same thing as before. I mean, what helped me tremendously when you started the course was for me to find other people, and you're here raising your hand and say, hey, whoever is interested in this, come join me. And for me, it was important to find that tribe and to take that into my company at the time and say, hey, Python's legitimately could do X, Y, and Z. And you might agree or disagree, but to have that conversation, to start that conversation and to have that mindset.
Yeah. And that is also that same idea as like, you know, I had mentioned in the last podcast how, you know, I'd been at AutoCon, and that definitely is one of the things I really liked about AutoCon is the talks that are especially the, success stories of people doing various things. Like I know Jeremy Shulman had his talk about Major League Baseball, and you know, there's other people that, you know, there was like a New York Times talk Kayon had done. So these kind of success stories where people do various things and they can potentially do things in novel ways. So it's like, oh, that's interesting, you know, that you did that thing that way, or you ran into that problem. So I think that can be sort of inspiring to see like, oh, here's some people that are doing some really interesting thing and solving their particular problems and realizing things that you might not have like, oh, I wouldn't have thought about that kind of scenario at all.
Right. And there was a talk by, I think it was Kat from Apple, right? So like, it's great to see different the spectrum of speakers who are willing to share, which is, to me, was the most valuable thing is How did you do that in a real world scenario where they may not all be successful, but they've also learned lessons from it? And what are those lessons learned? So let's talk about your Autocon experience. I couldn't make it this year, which I'm looking forward to attend in 2024. But what's your favorite part about that conference?
I thought it was a really good conference. I thought they did a very good job of putting it on. So as a disclaimer, like I'm involved like on the board of Autocon and helping them out. So I was involved in helping like select some of like the talks we were going to do. And
right.
And I did a couple of panels, one that I moderated and one that I participated in. But I thought the main two people that had put it on did an amazing job of putting it on. I thought there was a very good aspect of it. It was just a really high quality set of people. So there was a lot of very interesting conversations, hallway conversations, conversations at lunch where people would bring up various things. It's like, oh, I need to like look into that and I need to understand that better. Or, oh, I hadn't heard of that tool. I need to go find out more about that tool and see what it is and see if it's useful. And then it's just nice to be around people that are working on similar things as you and that you can have like really esoteric conversations about like, oh, I
don't have
like
to go back technology. To the basics. Yeah.
I don't like this technology. Okay. Like that. Okay.
Yeah. And I bet like there's people who maybe you have collaborated, maybe they submitted like a lot of PRs that you never met in person. Did that ever happen? Like the hallway track?
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the people I had one of my panels, I had interacted with Urs. I'm going to mispronounce his name, Urs Bauman. You know, he and I had interacted via the Network to Code Slack quite a bit and on some various pull requests. So that was really nice to get a chance to meet him in person. And then, you know, certainly there's a lot of other people that you just interacted a lot with via social media or via pull requests or via some Slack that you then get to meet in person, which is always very nice.
Nice. You're just like, oh, so you're, you know, Lion Cat 254, you know them by the handle versus like the real name. Yeah. So is there any project that's upcoming that's exciting to you? I know Jeremy Shulman, you know, mentioned OpsMill as being one of the more exciting projects that he's looking for.
And yeah, that was the one that really excited me, the one that Damien Garros is working on with OpsMill. I mean, it sounds really fascinating, so I'm definitely very interested in seeing what comes of that, what they build from that. You know, I've definitely known Damien for a while, and I've always been very impressed by all the work that he does. So, like, very interested in what they bring, and they're sort of assembling a, you know, a really good team of high-quality people. So I'll be really interested to see what they build there.
Yeah, I mean, looking forward to that as well. I mean, I had Damien on just a couple episodes ago. I think he talked mainly about the idea and the on the abstract level on what he's trying to build. You know, we're still all waiting for the launch of like the actual product where we could hand them. But I think there's beta that's opening, and I'm sure, you know, soon enough. I think he mentioned first half of 2024 that they wish to have something out for the public. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, and then other things aren't as new, but like, you know, container labs getting pretty common. And I know you talked to Carl, who I think is now working on Container Lab.
Yeah, I think the collaboration between Roman and Carl and a bunch of good people certainly made a lot of progress. I mean, that's my go-to platform for multi-vendor labs. I think, you know, CML, if you're doing Cisco stuff, is still, you know, kind of, I would say more resource light on the machine, on the my VM, but multi-vendor, definitely Container Labs.
Don't query me on any more names. I can remember like IP addresses from 25 years ago, but like, I literally can like forget names of people I've known for like 25 years.
My apologies to all these people who are distinguished, you know, engineers who have been on my show. Oh my God. Like, I'm so sorry. But, you know, it came from a good place from both of us, right? Like, you know, we never had any malicious intent on like disrespect or anything. You know, I respect all of them. I love my guests and you included, Kirk. You also mentioned you are the maintainer for a lot of open source projects. I've never done one myself. I mean, I contributed some, but I've never been a maintainer. So what are some of the issues or lessons learned from your perspective and running open source projects?
Let's pause for a quick word from NetBox Labs. NetBox Labs helps you build and manage complex networks. NetBox Labs can help you drive your network automation initiatives, As a network source of truth, NetBox Labs provides a foundation for device provisioning, automated testing, monitoring updates, and more. The company's NetBox Cloud product offers an enterprise-grade SaaS version of open-source NetBox, the world's most popular network source of truth. As the commercial steward of NetBox, NetBox Labs actively invests in the community to grow a thriving NetBox ecosystem. NetBox Labs helps customers accelerate network automation by delivering open, composable products and supporting the network automation community. Check out their educational network management webinars or join a NetBox meetup. Find out more at netboxlabs.com/events. That's netboxlabs.com/events.
I think there's some higher level questions you probably should ask yourself, which are questions related towards like, okay, why am I doing this? What's the objective that right. I want to accomplish here? And there are definitely things that you as an engineer can get out of these things that are pretty valuable. And by this, I mean, like, you can actually demonstrate your competency in areas that gives you avenues that, like, there's people that, you know, if I had the resources and was a company looking for hiring people, it's like, I could just say, well, I know that guy's good. Meaning, because like, I've seen his work and how he reasons about things and the contributions that he makes. And it would be way better than any complex interview that I could construct, because I've already sort of seen it in practice. And you can sort of build a name for yourself in certain ways that then gives you avenues to being like, oh, well, maybe you get invited to speak at Nanog, or maybe you get invited to AutoCon, or it opens up other avenues to you that you might not have. Now, there's that side of the equation for the values. And I think you should definitely ask yourself, you know, okay, why? What's my objective here? What am I hoping to accomplish? But then there's the other side of, well, it's a lot of work and you're not going to get paid anything for it. Right. And it sort of can become a process of everyone systematically hating you in a sense. Like, you frequently have to say no to people.
The guy who submitted that pull request with 44 file change.
Yeah, or like, you know, I had an example just today that I was working on where the person was saying that he thought X was implemented wrong, which is, you know, it's totally valid. And like, you could say like implemented wrong. But I also know that over the course of 8 years that I've worked on X, that specific thing, and I know it's really hard. And I know that it's crazy hard to change. And we're probably not going to really, at the end of the day, make it any better.
Right.
You know, if he has like a novel, oh, you know, it, what if you did X and there's something really novel about the thing that might actually make it better. But if it's just saying, well, this thing doesn't work the way I want it to work and there's no real, here's how we make it a lot better, you sort of just end up instead of saying, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but it's sort of just going to stay that way.
Right.
Which sort of then just makes other people think like, oh, he's just blowing me off. So it can be this process of making a lot of people not very happy. And then at the end of the day, it's sort of free work. So you definitely have to have a, you know, I don't really have any obligations here. Meaning like, if I was doing paid work and I had signed up to maintain your network, and I had given you a contract saying XYZ, well, then like, well, you call me at 2 a.m. and something's wrong.
Fair game.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to get up, drink my coffee and fix what's wrong. Right.
Yeah.
And be tired the next day.
Right.
You still want to do good work. You still want to do work you're proud of. You still want to have like, you know, if there's something really bad, you want to fix it, but you can't have this same kind of like relationship to it that you might want to with contractual work. And like, I'm probably old enough now that I wouldn't even agree to being woken up at 2 a.m. You know, like if you were paying me money, I would just say, no, nah, I'm not doing that anymore. You know, so it's like, I'm certainly not doing it for free.
Yeah, I mean, my wife wouldn't agree to that either, right? Like, I'll be spending, you know, a lot of time in the guest room whenever I'm on call, or, you know, being even having the potential of waking up. But I think that's a great point about decoupling your code versus you. Because when you're maintaining an open source project, it's almost like it has your name on it. I mean, same thing with writing a book, right? Your freaking face is on the cover, so that you feel like you're so bounded, your identity is tied to it. But it's important to kind of separate yourself from it and have some sort, at least a little bit of a boundary between the two for your open source project and you, for example, even though very tightly intertwined.
Yeah. And then you also do have to make sure you're not like closed-minded about like, well, if somebody makes a recommendation for something that is objectively better, okay, well, this is a good idea. Can we do this? Okay. How hard is it? What are the implications? But like, if it's a good idea, you know, it's like, okay, it probably should be done if it can make the thing that you're working on better. Now, obviously you have to prioritize your time and how much time you want to devote onto it and so forth. But you also can't be closed-minded just because you've worked on something a long time. Sometimes you don't see better patterns, you know, because you've been in the weeds for so long. But then somebody does actually say, oh, what if we did this? And it's like, oh, okay, well, that is interesting. Right. That might fix these things over here and might not cause some of these side effects that I'm worried about. Oh,
yeah, I mean, that's also, you know, even back to your original question on the person suggesting the X change, right? Like, you said no because you've been down that path and you could see the similarities and the benefit was only incremental. The benefit doesn't outweigh the cost versus someone who may suggest something and where you look at it objectively and say, well, that could be better and it's a more novel approach and so on to solve that same problem.
Yeah, and there's also interesting things in open source about just the life cycle of things on, okay, how long are you going to do this for? What do you do when you decide you don't want to do it?
Right.
Anymore?
There's a bunch of abandoned projects.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a little bit inherent in the life cycle of open source. And ultimately, it's up to like, if someone decides they don't want to maintain the project anymore, the project either gets taken over by someone else or it just ends. And that's sort of the way it is. And you also sort of have to think about that and decide what you want to do there. And it sort of comes back to a little bit of these questions of like, okay, why am I doing this? What are my objectives here? Do I still want to do these things? You know, these higher level questions that you're asking yourself, because, you know, you have to have personal reasons like why these things are valuable to you. And there are some other cool things about doing it that I do think it gives you this exposure to other things, especially if it's not your project, but somebody else's project that you're working on or helping with. Like, oh, okay, they're using these tools for certain things. Oh, what do those tools do? Can I incorporate these tools in just my normal work? You might see things, you might see patterns, especially like I work a lot just by myself, technically, you know, on my own projects and own work. So having this exposure to other practices, other patterns, other tools, maybe even other languages, you know, these can be things that give you capabilities, tools in the long run that could be valuable to you as well.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the life cycle and start with your why on, you know, your open source project. I mean, I think that's in general the issues facing open source is, you know, these tools could be used by multi-billion dollar companies all over, you know, even on space, like the request package. But ultimately, the maintainer is still a very small group of people, even just one person like yourself, who's maintaining that project. So how do we solve that? And I think some of these stuff that we see with the Python community, for example, is trying to find a solution for that. For example, you know, like the Python Software Foundation is being the fiduciary nonprofit that sponsor a lot of other nonprofit, you know, projects, right? Like the Flask project and the Jinja project, I believe, or some of the meetups on locally. It's so much paperwork for each of the meetup on, say, state of Washington or state of California to go be their own nonprofit and go through all the charters, then to just merge into the overall PSF. And they take care of like the one nonprofit that helps them all. So I think that is one aspect of it. And the other is, you know, how, you know, Guido retired and gave up the control really and giving up to the steering committee for the direction of Python and having the steering committee be no more than like two terms or, you know, having a, you know, 3-person, 5-person committee. So I think those are kind of solutions that they're trying to address for some of these issues that you talked about. Whether they succeed or not, we'll see.
I mean, I think those kind of things might work for bigger projects.
Yeah. For sure.
I don't think they're going to work for the vast majority of projects. It's sort of a little bit similar to like the Patreon model of doing things, in the sense of like this idea of like sponsorship where somebody's sort of almost charity donating money just doesn't work. I think people that I've seen that are sort of successful on it, like package or couple something else with it, you sort of have to build a business around it in some way, or something that has more economic viability around it. And I would sort of say that, like, for people that I see that do Patreon or podcasts successfully, they have something that's sort of a paid tier coupled with it in some way. But I mean, like, if I look at NetMiko, the total sponsorship dollars maybe would buy me and my wife like a steak dinner. Well, I make one exception to that, like Network.
Like, how big of a steak? Oh, no, just kidding.
There was one exception to that, but in general, excluding that one exception, it basically like maybe a nice dinner at you know, a restaurant in San Francisco. Sure. But then I did, you know, create a NetMiko course.
Yep.
And that's by far, you know, made more than, you know, just economically than the sponsorship model. But this also sort of comes back to like, okay, what are your motives in doing this? And these higher level questions of why you're getting involved. And there's other things that are really valuable that don't have like straight, like, oh, people are paying me sponsorship, you know, like, okay, well, I can learn new skills. I get a lot more higher profile. This could potentially lead me to job or other opportunities. And I mean, the same thing could apply with NetMiko. There's definitely like, it's given me opportunities and other things that would not have happened without me doing some of those things. So, and some of those things are really like hard to measure, right? Of like, okay, well, what's the straight, you know, maybe I do a live corporate training session because someone knew about me because I had made these NetMiko contributions, right? So some of these things are not as straightforward, but I don't think in general, I'm not very optimistic about the sponsorship model. Excluding like, you know, I could see for maybe very large projects like a Flask, like a Django, like a Request. Right. I could see how it could start to work for those very large scale projects.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many like other podcasts on like Django Talk or Talk Python where they try to address this problem on sustainability. And I do understand like there's a gap between, you know, large project, like your target is a little different. And it also has to do with the industry, right? Like our industry. But I do hear you on the sponsorship. Even for this podcast, you know, I started out with, in midway, it started with the Patreon model, but that didn't really work out. Like you said, like it's enough to buy, I don't know, not even steak dinner, like some Jamba Juice or whatnot. And no boost though, just the regular Jamba Juice. But yeah, so, and I ultimately just decided, like, instead of nickel and dime the individual listeners, I'm just going to go out and find a more sustainable model and so on. But I definitely hear you. It's kind of finding out your why is really the beginning. And then you kind of, you know, follow that thought train and find a business model that would sustain this project.
Yeah. And I also definitely very much have the framework of like, I just rather would be like, I have a set of things that are free and then I have a set of things that cost quite a bit of money.
Yep.
And it's just not sort of worth doing things in this sort of limbo. They basically round very close to zero. And it's just not sort of worth worrying about them. Because at the end of the day, it's just the sponsorship dollars at NetMiko just basically adds up to zero, essentially. You know, just like from the broader scheme of things. So it's not worth doing. It's better just to do it for free and not to worry about any of the hassles.
Yeah. I mean, when the CEO goes on those earning calls and say, this is immaterial. So it's still something, but it's just not, you know, it's significant enough to be mentioning. And just FYI, I mean, when we did the planning session, we covered about 2/3. There's still 1/3 of stuff that we haven't even covered. But so I'm going to invite you back on the show next time and we'll cover the rest of them, like publish the book. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts about, you know, maybe publishing a book later on, maybe just aggregate some of your free contents into a, you know, paper book formats or whatnot. But we'll cover that next time. So before we say goodbye, Kirk, is there any call to action your favorite engineering technology, I imagine, Narrow Automation. Your favorite Python package, hit me.
This sort of circles back to some of those AutoCon things. Like, you know, I think the Container Lab stuff is really interesting. I think the work that the Ops Mill people are doing, it's sort of interesting to see, you know, that's more forward looking, obviously, with the Ops Mill stuff. So I'm excited to see what they come out. Obviously, over the like the last 5+ years, maybe even longer, you know, the stuff with NetBox and Nautobot has been, you know, big. That's definitely moved the needle and, you know, had widespread use and adoption.
Right. So,
I mean, I do think, you know, there are these things where we're incrementally moving forward year by year in sort of enabling network automation across time.
Cool. Yeah. So ditto. I mean, I'm excited about a lot of those other things, and a Container Lab for sure. Really looking forward to, you know, more growth in that. And I hope one day we could have maybe not a digital twin, but maybe a digital cousin for your testing environment. And that would go a long way for that. So where can people follow you and find your work, Kirk?
Yeah, so probably the easiest way is to just search for Python for Network Engineers. You should see me very quickly there. I'm also on LinkedIn at Kirk Byers and Twitter at Kirk Byers. I should be pretty easy to find online.
Great. Yeah, I mean, those are great channels. And thanks again, Kirk, for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time. Like I said, this was one of the most enjoyable conversation, and I hope to continue this on next time so we could discuss all the other stuff that we haven't gone to this time.
Thank you very much for having me on, Eric. This was a good time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Network Automation Nerds. Do you have any feedback for Network Automation or Kirk himself? Send me some follow-ups at packetpushers.net/FU. I want to hear from you. Check out our website at packetpushers.net to find other network engineering-focused podcasts, blogs, YouTube videos, and Slack channels. Last but not least, remember that too much network automation would never be enough.